Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
You may know the name Jerry Allred from his having coached in Little League basketball and volleyball in Chico. But Jerry Allred earned a PhD in English and American Studies from the University of Utah and is retired from teaching and administrating in secondary, university, and graduate schools in Utah and California. Now he has written a book, but his book is about his life before Chico. The characters are based on real people in factual events. Jerry Allred says his stories are a version of creative nonfiction. The title of his book is Hideaways, Within and Outside My Polygamist Family. Jerry Allred, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, people might be surprised. Polygamist family? But this is now before you moved to Chico.
Long before.
Yes. And I was curious. People may wonder, well, what's the cover of your book about? Why do you have a barn on your cover?
The title story for Hideaways is a hideaway, and it's a story about my brother and I at 10 years old hiding from potential raids from the FBI. And my dad had a hideaway in a cubbyhole in one of our houses, and we figured we better get one too. So we built a little cave out of hay bales in the hayloft, and that is what the barn is about.
Besides this lovely barn, it looks like watercolors. It looks like a little figure peeking out the door. Is that you?
Carolyn Ayers, the artist who did this for me, did the barn, and it is watercolor. And I said, well, you know, we need to get the hideaway going in there. So I asked her to stick that little character in there. Peering out, yes.
Well, another thing I enjoy about talking to local writers, you just mentioned the artist who did your watercolor barn, but on the back is a photograph by a friend of mine, Dick Baldy. He took the photograph on the back of your book.
Yeah.
So did you meet him at the university, or how did you happen to get, because he wasn't a photographer, he taught at the university, Chico State.
Richard and his wife were good friends of Joanne's and mine. In fact, they were over for dinner one night, and I asked him if he'd honor me with a photo, and he did. He took several of them, and that's not the one I picked, but it's one if somebody else did. It's a good one, good enough. Yeah.
So you have a local artist doing the artwork, and you have a local publisher publishing it. So I thank you for the community of Chico for doing that. Now, you mentioned the first chapter in your book. The title of your book is Hideaways, and the first chapter is Hideaway. But I would like you to read the preface, if you would, from your book. And you explain some things that pique our curiosity. My goodness, Jerry, what do you mean by these stories?
Great. Thank you, Nancy. The preface sets the tone for the whole story and helps you understand how real things happen but get imagined in their recreation. And I think that happens in all writing.
Because you mentioned 10 years old. I don't remember much about what happened. I remember a few things, but you reproduce conversations when you were, say, 10 years old. Okay, go ahead and read what first of your preface.
These stories portray what happened and what might have happened in my being raised in a polygamous family. The characters are based on real people in factual events and settings, and at times they are imagined in experiences recreated from various versions found in family memories, journals, and records, as augmented by extensive related historical and literary rich research. These stories are another version of creative nonfiction. Being together in these stories, my real and imagined characters and I, we share identities, thoughts, feelings, and beliefs that are factual facets of individual lives and fictional figments of our collective imaginations. We have been created and recreated by one another separately, physically, and spiritually. Holy historical people are not intended to be in these stories. Being the family's eighth son and 14th child, I'm one of 48 children born to Dr. Ruland Clark Allred and his seven wives. My mother, Mabel Finlayson Allred, was his fourth plural wife, and her identical twin, Melba, was also her sister wife.
This is my guest, Jerry Allred, reading from his book, Hideaways, Within and Outside My Polygamist Family. Now, your dad's name was unusual enough that I thought, gosh, I'd like to know more about this guy because we learn a little bit as we go along. So I Googled the name Ruland Clark Allred, and it did say, now, his, you use the title doctor. He was not a medical doctor. He was not a licensed medical doctor, but he was, what was his specialty?
He was a naturopathic physician, which gave him a lot of medical training and a lot of services that were medical. He was most renowned for having helped birth at least 6,000 children, babies, in his career. And so he
now
was,
that sounds mythological.
It is. Well, he was a kind of a mythological figure, Nancy. He was not only the doctor of the bodies of thousands of saints in Utah and other places in the West, he was also the doctor of their soul because he was the high priest of the priesthood that oversaw this whole group.
He was also trained as a chiropractor, I understand.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so he was two kinds of doctor, if we may say that. Now, you say in your preface that you were the eighth son and 14th child, one of 48 children that Dr. Allred fathered. Now, when I looked up, you know, Wikipedia said that your dad had 48 children, just like you say that, and his seven wives, this is what you say in your book, Wikipedia said 18 wives.
Do you want some explanation?
Yes, please.
My dad was in a religion, very fundamental Mormon, that believed that if you were married properly in the right priesthood, you were for time and all eternity. His seven wives were for that. He married some other women, kind of as a caretaker of them. They were all elderly, most of them elderly in his later lives, in order to give them a sense of family and support.
My guest is Chico author Jerry Allred. The title of his memoir, Hideaways, Within and Outside My Polygamist Family. And I kind of hesitate to say memoir because it's a creative memoir, if I may say that. Now, you did mention that your first chapter, the title of it is Hideaway. And so this takes place, I think you mentioned you were 10 years old when this, you start your story. So I'm going to ask you to read a couple of paragraphs that begin your chapter, Hideaway.
May I just interject really quickly
here?
All the stories from this book are written from different points of view, whether I'm a 10-year-old or it's from my mother's point of view or my father's, and it depends on who the character is that's telling his or her own story and how old they are and what their role is in the family. So this is from Hideaways. We've just found out, my brother and half-brother and I, that all our mothers are going away to Mexico to hide out. And I'm not supposed to know what's going on. At dinner, Bubby, who's my Aunt Melba, told us about Mama and other mothers going to visit some friends for a while in a place called Monterey. When I wanted to know where they were going and why I couldn't go too, she said, "You have to go to school. You're 10 years old and you don't have to know everything. Besides, she doesn't want us to tell lies and says, if we don't know stuff, we can just say so." Well, I already know, but I didn't dare tell. I found out after Sunday school when Daddy held a meeting, family meeting, with just the mothers and the big kids. two of my older brothers came into the barn right underneath the hayloft, and we stayed quiet while we talked us into them. They talked about the police raids coming because Daddy's been living plural marriage when he's still on parole and isn't supposed to be with all seven of his wives or have more children with them. And what the hell do we do if the cops take our parents away and put all us kids in foster homes? What's the plan then? David wanted to know. Lewis didn't know, but he said maybe Daddy would have to go into hiding like Brother Van Hoff.
This is Chico author Jerry Allred reading from his book Hideaways. And you can see why this first chapter is called Hideaway. Now, this person you mentioned had a nickname, but her name was Melba, and she was a twin sister of your mother, Mabel, and she was also your dad's nurse, wasn't she?
She was his nurse and another of his wives.
Yes, he was married to both
both
sisters,
nurse.
And was also his nurse. So here's where we know why a barn was playing a role in your childhood, and you mentioned that they didn't want to tell you everything because then if people ask you questions, you didn't have to lie because you legitimately did not know. And so you have a concluding paragraph in that first chapter. If you would read that last paragraph in Hideaway.
Just a tiny bit of a lead-in. I have to go to school. I get into a fight at school. Not my fault, of course.
Of course not.
I run away from school, and coming home, a cop picks me up to bring me home, and I'm thinking, oh, they're going to find out everything. And so I'm going to go into hiding. Here's the last paragraph. I shuffle the yard into the barn and climb the ladder to the hayloft. Crawling backward into the tunnel, I scoop loose hay over the opening so there's only a little light coming into the hideout. Choking down some dry crackers with sips from my canteen and swallowing them with my worries, I roll Richard's gunny sack for a pillow and lie down, warm and safe in the quiet. The last thing I remember is Mama reminding me to say my prayers, and I do want to thank Heavenly Father. But after all I've done, I don't suppose he'd be listening.
And this is the author speaking as himself when he was 10 years old. And then you suffer things that just scare me, just thinking about somebody coming to my house and saying they're with the FBI. Oh, my gosh, there was so much that I found shocking in your book. And, I mean, you lived it. I'm assuming that these things are true, that some guy in a uniform flashes his FBI badge because your family was breaking a law.
Yeah. One of my mothers said there were 9 FBI agents on our property.
9 FBI agents coming to arrest you. That's just, oh, my gosh. So they go to jail. And here's your mother and her sister, and they meet a dark-skinned woman. And why was that kind of unusual for them?
It was just too wonderful an opportunity to have my mother look at the world in lots of ways in writing this story. This elderly woman was in the cell, when they were put in there. And she actually did a scene where she wakes Mom up with rubbing olive oil on her skin. And in the course of the interchanges, she becomes a kind of a foil for my mother, helping her learn things and see things and understand things.
See, for example, the color of her skin? She's not familiar with a woman with dark skin like that.
Oh, very seldom. She lived in Southern California, so she had met some, but she had never really known any of them. And of course,
so here she is in a cell with this black woman. And I thought it was interesting that your mother explains why polygamy. Because, I mean, if I were in a jail cell or had an opportunity to talk, I'd say, well, what's this polygamy? Your husband has more than one wife. So a mother explains to this woman why polygamy. Would you read that little paragraph?
Yeah. It's because God commanded it, Mabel explained. An angel told Abraham's wife, Sarah, to give her handmaiden to him so he could have many children. Another angel with a sword commanded the prophet Joseph Smith to take more than one wife or be cut off. That's why my sister and I are married to the same husband. But the real reason they were married to him is they thought it was the only way to get to the highest heaven was to live celestial plural marriage.
So your mother's explaining to this cellmate that she and her sister married the same husband because God commanded it. Now, did you run into people saying, oh, now, wait a minute, God commanded polygamy? When you were growing up, you probably just accepted what you were told. Is that the case?
In degrees, yes. Not just wholehearted. I was always a wanderer. But the history of Mormonism is such that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, and he had God give him a revelation, I'll say it that way, that said, if you want to get to heaven, you got to do it. And so it came through many, many of the early members of the church practiced polygamy.
So polygamy, this was your mother's explanation of why polygamy. One explanation I heard from somebody who grew up in Utah as a Mormon was that when they were coming from Missouri, so many of the husbands got killed, and here were these women without husbands to take care of them, and so it made sense practically that a man would take more than one wife because he took care of them, and that was the way of caring for these widows. Had you ever heard that?
Oh, sure.
Oh.
That was one of the ways those extra wives came along. Others were by choice on both sides.
My guest is Chico author Jerry Aldred, and he's written a book about his polygamist family. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm back with my guest, Chico author Jerry Aldred, and we're talking about his having grown up in a polygamist family. So they've arrested your family, and you have a section in your book that's taking place in jail. And so would you read this section of your book?
Sure. This is when the FBI are in the house and Mom has been upstairs taking care of her children, and she walks into the living room. When she entered the front room, Rulin, that's my dad, was pacing barefoot with the shirt tails out of his pants. With his blonde hair awry and his face ashen, he was talking with his hands to one of the agents. Others were milling about the house, and another matron stood behind the girls by the front window. Shaking his head and brushing past Rulin, the agent, who appeared to be in charge, stopped in front of the matron and shuffled through a file of papers. That's all of them? Six? And the kids with Grandma. How many? 12, the matron reported, and not one of them looks older than 5 or 6. Melba was motioning to her, and when Mabel started across the room, the agent raised his hand. You must be the other twin, Mabel Finlayson? She nodded while he cocked his head at Rulin. For now, it looks like we'll take just you two and the doctor downtown. Mabel's heart was in her throat when Rulin put a protective arm around her shoulder. He was trying to be brave, and in his bloodshot blue eyes was a just awakened wildness. He tried to tell the agents how upset he was that their home had been invaded and his wives and children terrified. "You know this is a free country, and we have a right to our religious beliefs," he explained. "My brothers are overseas fighting a war against nations that are threatening all our rights." "Don't tell me. Tell it to the judge. You've seen the search and arrest warrants I served on you and all your wives. Now get dressed and hurry up about it. Somebody get coats for the twins."
This is Chico author Jerry Allred reading from his book, Hideaways, Within and Outside My Polygamist Family. And this is taking place. Now, she mentioned a reference to World War II. And so this, I don't think we mentioned that this is taking place in 1944. So why would anybody, I mean, the next door neighbor, why would they care about polygamy? So who was it? Who complained, Jerry? Who complained that there was a polygamist family, your dad's family? Who complained? Who wanted to turn them in?
The church, the Mormon church, members of the church. You see, polygamy was practiced widely in the church until 1890, when the manifesto forbade it. And yet, and so it kind of became a dirty stain on the front of the church. And they were intent on getting rid of it to kind of complete their absorption into the larger culture. And so I used to have a huge file of all this from all the records until the campfire burned it all. But in any event, the church set up, supported the grand jury, testified, and they had a long history of arresting polygamists. And this was just another time in my dad's life. He ended up in prison for 5 months over it, and my mom and Melba for longer. Okay, or not that long.
So your dad had to spend time in prison for having more than one wife.
Actually, technically, it was for conspiracy and for cohabitation.
Yes, I remember that, cohabitation. And I think it was a felony. A felony.
Yes.
Cohabitation was a felony.
That was in those days.
Yeah. My goodness. So if this is going on, you better get out of there. Maybe you better leave Utah. So where does the family go? Where do you go?
Well, they go to Mexico at the behest and kind of vision that one of the priesthood leaders, not my dad, had, that said, this guy is going to take you down there to Mexico, and he wants to build a colony of the faithful saints, and I want you to go down there and do it with him. And my dad was already looking for a reason to go there because he was continually being harassed by the law and the threat of going back to prison. So they decide to go to Mexico. He goes down early. Five of the wives come later with 11 of the kids in two cars.
Oh, my gosh.
And one of the car drivers abandons them at the border.
Yeah, that was a tough chapter to read, Jerry, I got to tell you. But now your dad was born in Mexico himself.
Yeah, the Mormon colonies down there. One of them was Dublon, where he was born in 1906.
And why was he born in Mexico?
For the same reason he was going to Mexico. His father and his grandfather both fled the states seeking sanctuary from the law and the church, and they ended up in these Mormon colonies, which were settled by Mormons, many Mormons who practiced polygamy.
Well, that, like I say, that just getting to Mexico, the family, without your dad, oh my gosh. What do you remember about that time?
Well, I was 3 years old, okay, and not quite three, but I do remember being in Mexico. But I have not only the records from the family. Right after I moved to California, I went with a tape recorder and went to all of my mother's and my dad's sisters and brothers, and I had this huge supply of tapes, which was their accounts of the trip to Mexico and living in Mexico. And so this story is based on that, especially Bubby's journal, which is just a gold mine.
Bubby's your aunt, by the way.
And Melba, her journal is a gold mine, and I liberally used it with her permission.
Yeah, so you have sources records of what they were experiencing right there from their own, in their own words.
Oh, yes.
So that's why your chapters are told from different points of view, as you mentioned.
That's why I call it a novel family memoir.
Yeah.
Because it is the whole family is helping tell the story.
Yeah, you say this is a novel family memoir. And I think, okay, novel can mean like unusual, like a novel idea. But novel is also a kind of book. So I thought that was wordplay on your part to call it a novel.
Yes.
Memoir, novel book. Well, Mexico, you were only 3 years old, so you don't remember much about that. So where do you go when the family returns, when it leaves Mexico, where do you go?
We came after about 9 months and almost starving to death and having disease and everything else. We came back to Salt Lake. And my dad had to go back into parole or to turn himself in because he jumped parole. But it was really an unusual thing. One of his leaders had prophesied that he wouldn't go to jail. He was in there for about 3 days, and they let him out. But he had to agree, his condition of parole, that he didn't live with his wives.
Your dad was certainly an interesting character. And he was it his idea to go to Elko, Nevada?
As my dad did many times in our lives, we had to split up because the law hounded him continually. And in 55, when I was 10, not long after we had the other story, he moved my mom and her twin to Elko, one of the other ones to Albuquerque, one to Pocatello, others to different places around the West. And he spent his doctor's license was taken. And so he spent several years traveling around the country, working and seeing his family. We saw him maybe once a month or once every other month when we were in Elko. He just wasn't available. No, he came at nighttime undercover, so.
Yeah, that I hadn't realized how many different, not colonies, I'm not sure what you would call them, in all these different places you could go to a Mormon community in all these different places. So you had brothers, you had friends, and what do you, so when you would go to these places, you would go to school, and but sometimes you didn't want to go to school. For example, when it was deer hunting season, and I mentioned to this dear friend of mine that you have tell stories about going deer hunting, and she says, oh, deer hunting is a big deal in Utah, because that's where she grew up as a Mormon. And she said, I think you get an extra holiday during deer season. And there was, that was a surprise. So did you skip school to go deer hunting, or what were your adventures in deer hunting?
We did. We survived in a lot of ways by hunting. You know, Nancy, one of the things that's really fascinating about this is we went undercover when we moved to Elko and everything else. And even though my brother ended up the student body president and we were very well known, in my 7 years living there until I was a senior in high school, I never told one of my friends about my family. And I wrote in the introductions a little comment about the need to keep hidden all the time, created a kind of a...
It's in your title, Hideaways.
Yeah. Yes. It created kind of a split identity that was covered up by kind of fabrications and half-truths, and we lived in that. That was the environment. I not only didn't want my parents to get in trouble, I didn't want to be that strange in my social and expanded life. And so I meshed right into Elko. I ended up loving it right away, and I played sports and did all those kinds of things, but never with the cover blown off my family.
And that, as a reader, that my heart went out to you to not be able to tell your closest friends what your life was like, what your home life was like.
My choice. You know, my choice. I just didn't want to be in that judgment when I was with friends and all.
Well, you made your own decisions a lot of the time, and they weren't always what your dad liked either, but he kind of admired that. Yeah, you're like me, son. So you also have a chapter on rabbit hunting. And what happened when you went rabbit hunting?
We'd stopped from fishing, got out to go rabbit hunting. We were very good shots. My brother had a hair-triggered gun. And the way he told it, he was tying his shoelace.
Because you didn't witness what happened. You didn't witness it.
No,
he had to tell you what happened.
No, he told me this after.
Right.
But he said the gun had bumped against him and it shot him in the chest with a .22 long rifle. It missed his heart by about a quarter of an inch, chipped a rib, and punctured his lung. And he came running back to the car to where I was with blood coming out of him. And we jumped in the car and raced to town and got him there in time.
So here your brother's shot in the chest, and you've got to get him to a doctor, and your dad's a doctor. Why couldn't you take him to your dad?
Well, he was clear in Salt Lake, 250 miles away.
And this is happening in
Elko, Nevada.
Right. So, okay, so dad's too far away, and you're wondering, how can we take this kid to the doctor? How are we going to pay? And how did you resolve that situation with your brother? Missing his heart by just a fraction of an inch.
Yeah. Well, my other brother, 2 years older, between Dave and me, Joe, was just about 16. And he knew how to drive. And he drove us to the hospital. My job was to keep an eye on him, make sure he was still breathing.
And
when we got
didn't
there...
Didn't pass out. And didn't pass out.
Oh,
that
yeah.
was your job, to keep
yeah.
him from passing out.
Yeah, and he did. And we realized... Joe said he's passed out because he sees his own blood, and that's he had done that before, but he was in rough shape. Yeah.
Well, so you have mentioned beer coming into the picture, and you aren't supposed to be drinking beer, and none of you Mormons are supposed to be drinking beer. Is that correct?
Please state that again.
Well, you have in your chapter... The title is Kissing Josephines. This is 1960. But beer entered the picture, and you're not supposed to be drinking beer, Jerry.
Oh, no. No. I experimented like all kids do, but I didn't like beer. It was not something I really enjoyed. But I did like running around with my friends, and so I, with my buddy Kenny, and we pick up two girls, one of them older than me, and I get my first lesson in kissing. And Josephine was a master at it.
Well, you also have a chapter when you're looking at stars, this giant red giant star, and the pronunciation, it's pronounced Betelgeuse. It's not spelled that way, but it's pronounced Betelgeuse. And so you are learning about the stars from this other boy who was quite smart.
Yeah, actually, it was one of the other men. That was one of the priesthood men who had been in the army and had seen constellation charts, and he knew what was going on. And my dad saw everything from the lens of the gospel and what he'd been taught in scriptures. And so one of the things Joseph Smith claimed is that star up there is Kolob, near where God lives. And so my dad and the two brethren were arguing about which one was Kolob. And Betelgeuse was what one of them picked out. And the redheaded guy who stutters in the story.
Yes.
Robert,
and at first we don't know why. Betelgeuse. Yeah. So
anyway, he argues with my dad. And of course, when he says, Dad says, you can't tell far that way that is because just by looking, he says, well, scientists know how fast light travels. And Dad says, no, that's not how God and his angels and spirits go. They do it in the twinkling of an eye. And that's what they believed.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have a chapter about having to beat up this other kid or getting beat up. You're not supposed to be doing that, Jerry. How did you, you were boxing.
Fist fighting.
Yeah. And how old were you then?
17.
Okay. So you're about finishing high school.
Yeah, it was my last half of my junior year.
Yeah. Oh. So, and the coach would say, yeah, well, if you're going to be beating up on each other here, at least wear boxing gloves. So how did you feel about that?
You know, the fight was kind of my fault. I was trying to be a hero and take care of my girlfriend who was being hassled by this older kid, bigger kid.
Yeah,
it was always kind of a bully. And so we got into a situation where I told him to knock it off. And then later on, he slugged me when I wasn't looking. And then he did it again. And I was between having to kind of act like I was a tough guy sometimes so I didn't get in fights. I ended up getting in a fight and breaking my hand doing it.
Yes. You had to wear a cast of breaking your hand all because you thought this guy was insulting your girlfriend.
You see, he was.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I did get a few licks in, and he didn't get off scot-free.
My guest is Chico author Jerry Aldred, and he has written a book about his polygamist family when he was growing up in Utah. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And my guest today has written a book about growing up in a polygamist family. The author is Jerry Aldred. There's a point when your dad poses a question that I think, now that's a really good idea. He asked the people to tell everybody about the lessons they had learned. And you said that this was after an event that was kind of shocking. This is in your chapter where you your daddy's teaching lessons and stories about the Bible brothers who didn't get along and about Cain and Abel. And then toward the end of that chapter, daddy's telling everybody about... what lessons did you learn? Because I found that was helpful when a friend of mine was saying his girlfriend broke up with him and like he was blaming her. And I said, well, what did you learn? And he said, well, and he had excuses and some time went by. I asked again, what did you learn? He finally came up with, admitted what he learned. So I really like the fact that your dad asked this question. Would you tell us that section of your book?
This story is called Muskrat's Sevenfold.
Yes.
Richard and I, the same friend, close one, I said, play a prank on one of my other half-brothers and get him to put his hand in a muskrat trap, which is didn't really hurt him. He just ran around with it. And then we're in trouble. And, of course, the mothers decide daddy's going to solve the whole thing. So he comes home. We have to explain what happened. And our punishment was to put our hands in the muskrat trap 7 times each, but it didn't really hurt. Or gets butter platter 7 times. We knew what to choose. Anyway, Daddy stopped with the end. Daddy says the last part, or the story says the last part was Daddy making everyone tell everybody else about the lessons they learned. He and Richard said not being mean and teasing and being sorry for hurting Sammy and not minding Aunt Kathleen. And Sammy said he'd try not to get so mad next time. Daddy made them all promise to practice what they learned. What surprised everybody was Aunt Kathleen coming for, this is Sam's mother, coming, who was chasing with us with a switch, was coming forward, kind of crying about what she had learned, asking the other mothers, even the boys, to forgive her for stepping over the line when it was their mother's job to spank them. Sometimes she just couldn't help herself. Before she was finished, Mama had put her arms around her and whispered in her hair. When Aunt Leona did that, Daddy looked happy with all of them.
This is Chico author Jerry Allred, and he's reading from his memoir, Hideaways, Within and Outside My Polygamist Family. So I like that question that your dad posed about what they learned. But you didn't really have talks with your dad. And there's a section of your book, and I don't think you're unusual with this. I think dads in that time didn't sit down and have talks with their kids. They were too busy earning a living and making sure they provided. And the chapter that where you describe your talk with your dad, this is 1962, June of 1962, and the title is How the World Was Made. And so would you read the first couple of paragraphs in How the World Was Made?
Okay. Really what my dad's talk and I had was about the difference between spiritual or scriptural and scientific accounts for how creation happened. So it was a Sunday evening when Daddy told me he didn't want me a son in his house who wouldn't obey. It wasn't just that I'd gone fishing instead of off to church like he asked me to, or that he'd asked Mama to tell me to pay my own way when I was freeloading. Mostly what got me cast out was not wanting to obey what he obeyed. Our standoff ended the only long talk I ever had with Daddy, just the two of us, about much of anything. Daddy was convinced that his faith should be and eventually would be true for every person who ever lived or else. Anything different was pretty much wrong or misguided, even the Mormon Church, when it came to living according to God's highest laws and commandments. His main purpose in life was to get himself and his family saved for eternity in heaven's top tier, and the only way to get there was to be obedient. Growing up, I'd heard plenty about religion from him, about the only true and not so true church, and I'd pretty much tried to go along with who and what I was supposed to believe in.
This is Jerry Allred reading from his memoir, Hideaways, and this Sunday evening, your dad says, "You don't want you living in your house if you're not going to obey me. You can't live here." And he told you to go to church. You didn't go to church. You went fishing instead. And he would not want to tell you things directly. He would ask your mother, his wife, "What you tell Jerry not to do this or to do that." And he had your mother tell you to pay your own way when you're freeloading. And it was because you weren't obeying when he told you and he expected you to obey as his son. So that's tough to hear, but you seem to take it in stride. Okay.
The way it was.
That's the way it was. So this is still your talk with Daddy. And would you read about the fact that the science was, he didn't want to go along with the science.
He didn't want me to go back out to Elko on my own, which I had done. And he was trying to convince me not to. The science stuff I was interested in was part of the wicked world Daddy wanted to guide me away from. And driving home from fishing, I knew I'd be in trouble with him if I didn't get cleaned up before we talked, mucked up and smelling fishy as I was. Maybe I'd be off the hook, if I was lucky, if he got called on a doctor's emergency or decided to spend the night at one of the other mother's places. When I turned the corner onto 6th East, my heart skipped a beat and sank. Daddy's station wagon was parked on Mama's side of the duplex so he'd be spending the night with her. I considered driving on by, but knew I had to face the music sooner or later. My plan was to sneak in the back door, go downstairs to my basement bedroom, change quickly, and clean up in the laundry sink. Through the kitchen window, I saw Daddy playing solitaire at the table. He seldom played any kinds of games on Sunday or approved others of doing so, but he loved cards and played to relax. He must have heard me because he looked up at me and motioned me in with his head. Busted. I shucked my muddy shoes and socks on the stoop. Inside, he looked me up and down, his blue eyes bloodshot and red around the rims. Mama had said that he'd been out delivering a baby most of the night, and he looked like he was worn out after a day of meetings. Nobody else was home, so I guess they were staying late for choir practice and dinner at Uncle Owen's place. "You've been hard at work at doing something that doesn't look and smell like grease and gasoline. Where you been? There was nothing to do but fess up. He kinked the corner of his mouth and caught me off guard. Catch anything? After nodding, as I told him about wading in to free up a big brown trout snagged on roots, he got serious. You know, I'm disappointed that you broke your word to your mother. He paused, and when I started to explain, said, I'm concerned that you don't make the work of the Lord more important in your life and show so little diligence in contributing to your family's welfare. That's what he wanted to talk with me about, not going to church and not paying tithing or half my earnings to the family as he expected his children living at home to do. He knew I was trying to save, to go back to Elko. My cheeks heated up some with shame and resentment. I dropped my eyes and kept mum. Daddy waved his hand at the chair across the table. Sit down, son.
This is Chico author Jerry Allred, reading from his memoir, Hideaways, Within and Outside My Polygamist Family. And one of the few times, I guess, your dad ever sat down and talked to you. And we're wondering, well, what happens to the dad? Because you're telling this story just in your youth. And I don't know if you want to tell what happened to your dad, because, like I say, I was so curious, I Googled.
You mean how he got the way he is in this story?
Well, yeah. How was that?
Well, he came from a long line of polygamists. He himself went into the church, got in an argument with my grandfather, who was a polygamist, who convinced him that he needed to live it. And it was all based on a heavenly visitation in 1886, where Jesus and Joseph Smith came down and passed the authority to practice plural marriage onto the then church president, John Taylor. My dad inherited that knowing, and when he was in the church, his father convinced him that that was the truth. His first wife with three children left him as a result of this, and he came home. Within 5 years, he had married six of his seven wives, and was well on his way to building his earthly kingdoms and his heavenly kingdoms for God. That's what he was doing there, and he just absolutely believed in it and absolutely wanted everybody. It was kind of an idealistic man who thought he could help save everybody in the highest kingdom of heaven. And I don't know what he thought we would be doing up there. It was kind of an eternal progression thing.
Well, and he seemed to be doing good in the world. So that's why his demise was so shocking. And I don't know if we want to tell listeners how your dad died, because it's...
Yeah, Nancy hasn't heard about my father, but he's very famous. He was murdered by a man from Mexico that was on the ranch, the son of the owner of the ranch went to.
Do you know how I know he must have been famous? Because when I read Wikipedia, it didn't say he was murdered. It said he was assassinated.
Assassinated? About the same thing.
Somebody of higher standing is known as assassinated.
This family in Mexico, the Liberans, the father was really quite a wonderful guy. I'm writing about him right now. But three of his sons, at least, founded their own church. And Ervil killed two of his own brothers because they wouldn't bow down to him. My dad wouldn't bow down. And his other brother wouldn't go along. And so Ervil killed my dad, had two of his young wives, made them go disguised with guns and shoot him in his doctor's office.
That's just—it's hard to—that's real shocking that they shot him in his office. And there are so many stories in here that I just got a kick out of. They made me laugh because I really enjoyed the way you tell a story. I got to tell you, Jerry, I really did. And I think people will enjoy your book on a lot of levels, maybe because they lived through that time. But let me tell people again the title of your book, and it is Hideaways Within and Outside My Polygamist Family, and the author is Jerry Allred. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, Nancy.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Millions, billions, and trillions. I explain things in confusing ways, I know that. A grandson asked me about a million, billion, and trillion, and I think he was confused by the amount and the similar names that they had. Keep it simple, I said to myself. The three kids listened. He brought in his two brothers. 1 million seconds takes 12 days to go by. 11.6 days, but who has time for decimal points when my explanation is at risk? Got it? I asked. The three heads nodded. I was sure that they wanted to hear more, so I was there to give it to them. 1 million seconds takes 12 days. 1 billion seconds takes 32 years. 1 trillion seconds takes 32,000 years. I was getting carried away with my own explanation. A different, detailed explanation was needed. I changed my tactic. Want to spend $1 million? Six eyes popped open like big brown buttons. $1 million, they asked. Yep, they wanted to hear more. I knew they did, so on I went. It would take you 3 years to spend $1,000 a day to reach $1 million. $1 billion spent at $1,000 a day would take 3,000 years. And if you were to spend $1 trillion at the rate of $1,000 a day, it would take you 3 million years. That's a lot of birthdays. I was caught up in my own web. Do you see the difference between 1 million, billion, and trillion? I asked. Eyes were glazed over, but their heads nodded, probably in unison, probably not even knowing that each of the others were nodding. No chance of stopping now. I pushed onward. Last example. A stack of $100 bills totaling $1 million would be 4 feet tall. A stack of $100 bills totaling $1 billion would be 4,000 feet tall. And if you had a stack of $100 bills totaling $1 trillion, it would be 789 miles straight up. If you wanted to lay it down, it would reach from Chico to Denver. Maybe I could tell the class tomorrow that they could walk from Chico to Billings, Montana, on a trail of $100 bills, said one of my grandsons. Well, I know it's 790 miles from Chico to Denver, but I'm not so sure it's 790 miles to Billings, Montana. Oh, we learned in geography that it is. Phoenix, Salt Lake City, Amarillo, they're all about the same distance, Grandpa. Really? I asked in disbelief. I completely lost track as to who was teaching whom. You want to know about other cities that are about the same distance from Chico? Sure, but in a second. Need any more help seeing the difference between 1 million, billion, and trillion, I asked. No, thanks, Gramps. I think we've got the idea. They disappeared in an instant. My son, their dad, was looking at me, smirking. I stared straight back and asked in an aggressive manner, what? What's wrong with that? Mark Malinger.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.